Good evening. This plunge into the talk gives a literal meaning to the idea that the speaker needs no introduction, because I am the speaker. And therefore, I will not introduce myself, but my name is up there. How sweet. How welcoming. Well, let me begin by saying I'm very grateful to be invited to speak briefly at this remarkable, important, interesting event. And I'm here, as I have been in the past, due to the invitation of my admired friend, Bernd Scheller, who is well aware that I am close to ignorant about the Bauhaus and only somewhat more knowledgeable about the general space in which it belongs. But because my sensibility is, how to put it, somewhat fox-like or opportunistic about many subjects, he, I think, thought perhaps this would be a good occasion for me to think a bit about this subject. And indeed, I have thought about it because you know, it's not something I think about in my daily work over the long term. But of course, I'm aware of what the Bauhaus has meant in a general way in architecture, but also geographically in Europe and in the world, more importantly, which is what I'm going to talk about, more than about the Bauhaus as such, on which many of you, indeed all of you, probably know much more than I. So with that introduction, let me also add that I'm grateful not only to HKW and to Bernd and his colleagues, but also to the other sponsors who are involved in the series of events going on in Germany this year, but who are also sponsoring this event, who are directly involved with the ongoing life of the Bauhaus. I should also apologize for the fact that I was unable to be here earlier today because I'm somewhat less than 100% well and wanted to be sure that I could come. So I had to miss some of the excellent talks today, and I hope there will be other channels through which I will benefit from that conversation. But I am not a great believer in helicoptering in and out. In fact, I really don't like it at all. So I do want to sincerely apologize for that. So that said, the title, which is not up there, so I'll tell it to you, which I gave to Bernd, and I hope I can make sense of it, of this short presentation, about 20 minutes, is The Politics of Forms and the Forms of Politics. So the first half will be a few general thoughts about forms. And then in the second part, rather abruptly, I'll say something about the Bauhaus in and in relation to India. So our era of globalization, approximately from the 70s to the present, is characterized by the flows not just of cultural substances, but also of cultural forms, such as the novel, the ballet, the political constitution, and divorce, to pick just a few examples. The flow of these forms has affected major world historical processes, such as nationalism, famously discussed by Ben Anderson in 83 and since. Today, however, the flow of forms also affects the very nature of knowledge, as whole disciplines, techniques, and ways of thinking move and transform in the process. Examples of global flows of such knowledge forms include the spread, say, of internet gaming in China, the growth of day trading of stocks in places like Tokyo, Shanghai, and beyond, the writing of constitutions in post-monarchic societies such as Nepal and, of course, many in Europe over the last 30 years, and, say, the popularity throughout the world of such visual forms as the Japanese manga. This is all the global flow of knowledge forms, in my view. Crucial to an understanding of these cultural flows is the relationship, and this is what I very briefly want to open up in this first part of my talk, is the relationship between the forms and the politics of circulation. Forms such as novels, films, and newspapers meet well-established circulatory paths and circuits of religion, migration, and trade. But other cultural forms, such as ballet, animation, fashion, photography, and grassroots political activism, create paths of circulation which did not exist before. So the one is moving on paths that exist, the other is creating paths. Thus, the 21st century, in my view, is witnessing new tensions between the actually circulating cultural forms and the emerging, partially culturally formed paths or networks that shape and cover the multiple paths of circulation. By forms, in quotes, a heavily loaded word, I mean to indicate a family of phenomena including styles, techniques, or genres which can be inhabited by specific voices, contents, messages, and materials. Unfortunately, the philosophical conundrum of separating form from content I cannot reveal either today or any day. In using the word form, I simply wish to temporarily place the issue of global circulation on a slightly more abstract level than it usually is. I've indicated that some recent forms that have been discussed in this way already are the nation form and the novel form, whose relationship was forcefully argued by the great Ben Anderson, whom I mentioned, who helped us all, many of us, to redefine nationalism by linking it to print capitalism, by also helping us understand nation and narration, reading and citizenship, imagined and affective communities. There have been many other additional inquiries since his book first came out into how the novel form has circulated and how it has been transformed in the process, along with other literary forms and genres. The example of nation, or the examples of nation and narration, are a useful reminder that different forms circulate through different trajectories, generate diverse interpretations, and yield different and uneven geographies. There are novels without nations and nations without novels. So globalization is never a total project capturing all geographies with equal force. Indeed, the circulation of forms produces new and distinct genre experiments, many of which are forced to coexist in uneven and uneasy combinations. One lesson here is that we need to move decisively beyond existing models of creolization, hybridity, fusion, syncretism, and the like, which have largely been about mixture at the level of content. Instead, we need to probe the cohabitation of forms, such as the novel and the nation, because they actually produce new contexts and new contents through their peculiar inflection of each other. A slightly closer look at the forms of circulation, as opposed to the circulation of forms, which seems familiar. Sure, ballet moves, something else moves, architecture moves, etc. But what about the forms of circulation? Here are some very brief thoughts. The forms or parts of circulation are closely tied to the circuits through which they occur, the speed with which they occur, and the scale on which they occur. Not everything moves through the same circuits. Humans move in boats, ships, trains, and cars. Pictures, words, and ideas move through a variety of other circuits, which now include cyber paths of various kinds. Blood circulates through certain circuits, money through others, arms, drugs, and diseases through yet others. Speed is a property that shapes the circulation of different forms. At the same time, it is an element of the forms of circulation. Spatial scope is another formal key feature of circulatory processes. Linguistically mediated forms tend to have certain genre characteristics which produce effects over certain terrains. Therefore, recognizing that circulation itself has some formal properties, mainly in terms of time, space, and scale, has also led me to think that bumps and blocks, disjunctures and differences are produced not just by cultural variety or some kind of social unevenness, but by the variety of circuits, scales, and speeds that characterize the circulation of cultural elements. All modernities emerge in the tension between heavy traffic and the opposite, slow traffic. In other words, while it is true that I have argued, along with many other people, that histories produce geographies, because very often we think the reverse, that there are places and then they have histories and so on and so forth. So for someone like me, who's a kind of regional scholar of India and so on, very important to have unlearned that and to say that histories produce geographies, not landmasses, you know, yielding some kind of historical agency. So, in other words, while it is true that histories produce geographies, the shape, form, and durability of these geographies is also a matter of obstacles, roadblocks, and traffic jams. I say this partly as having been one of the early enthusiasts of the idea of global flow and having been duly scolded for acting as if the world had no blockages at all. So now I'm duly noting in my age, older age, that of course, you know, flow is not a free thing, that everybody goes everywhere and all ideas move. There are blockages. But the study of that relationship is not simple. So in order to comprehend how alterity, otherness, so to speak, is produced in a globalizing world, we need to consider both the circulation of forms and what I would call the politics of circulation. Such a theory, I think, can tell us something useful about the reason why, for example, universities move less swiftly than, say, assault rifles, or why globally democracy is held in higher esteem, even today, than the American presidency. So what I'm indicating is that this is looking at circulating forms, both in terms of the idea of form itself and forms that move, as well as the circuits or paths along which those forms move, is the place to look for the politics of form. It's not about this movement or that movement or resisting this thing or supporting that thing or mobilizing this. I think it has a deeper meaning. At least that's what I want to get at. And I will get to that rather than by boring you further with these rather arid thoughts, going to the question of the Bauhaus in India for the second part of my talk, which I hope will be roughly the same time as this first part. So the Bauhaus in India. The story of the internationalization of the Bauhaus sensibility has recently received serious attention in the work of various scholars, curators, and historians, best exemplified indeed by the Bauhaus Imaginista project, some of whose distinguished sponsors are, of course, also sponsoring this conference. As far as India is concerned, the writings of Vikramaditya Prakash on Chandigarh and Corbusier, the less known wonderful essay by Saloni Mathur on the Eames brothers, which I recommend to all of you. It's a great piece, and I know Saloni well, and I know her work well, but I didn't know this particular essay. It's a great essay. And of Ravi Kalia on Nehruvian modernism and architecture, major example. So I, all this to say, you know, there are people who've done great work on modernist architecture in India, and this is just a few of them. So there has been special attention, again, as people at HKV know, Brent knows because he was part of supporting it, paid to the early 20th century connection between Tagore and the Bauhaus and the important role of Calcutta in the 1920s in making the Bauhaus vision known and appreciated in India. For me, the main, this is a side point, intrigue with that event and that history is, of course, again, the lack of a time gap. It's not that there's Bauhaus and 100 years later somebody in Calcutta begins to think about Bauhaus. It's like cinema. Lumiere brothers, Indian cinema, they're happening together. And again, those of us who study other parts of the world discover that these large lags on which our training is built are actually simply wrong. They're just incorrect. So that Calcutta moment is crucial to me for many reasons. That's one. But I'm not going to talk much about that because there's been a conference on that. It's well discussed. It's well known. But go on to something slightly different about the Bauhaus in India, slightly indirect. So in my view, there are two ways to look at the life of the Bauhaus in India. One is relatively specialized and involves the complex ways in which European and American architectural modernism traveled to India through the links between Corbusier, Gropius, Mies, and their followers in the US, many of whom names you know well, especially in Chicago, Philadelphia, and Cambridge, Massachusetts, who became teachers of the first generation of great modernist architects in India, which includes Charles Correia, probably the best known, Balkrishna Doshi, Habib Rahman, many others, and then their students who then came back to the US, so lots and lots of circuits, way beyond my special knowledge, but of which I'm keenly aware. And this is a story that others have told and should tell much better than I ever could. But the story I do feel I can help to tell or suggest that we should tell, very briefly, is the iconic story about Indian modernism in the domain of art, architecture, planning, and design. This is the story of Jawaharlal Nehru, the first Prime Minister of India, and Le Corbusier and their iconic planned city, the city of Chandigarh in today's Punjab state in India. Well-studied case, of course. Chandigarh has received a lot of attention for almost a half century from architects, urban planners, designers, art and architecture historians. These scholars have shown us how Le Corbusier and Nehru, in spite of serious disagreements, shared a broad idea about architectural modernism and its emancipatory potential. And that is what I want to understand, of course, because that's what politics is about. And were able to bring into being as a total urban vision, that is Chandigarh, which continues as a living, more or less, success today, as a lived city. For Nehru, India was a society that needed to wake up from its long sleep and be brought rapidly into the realm of industrial modernity. His vision, as many have shown, was secularist, socialist, scientific, and technocratic. He saw railroads, steel plants, dams, and heavy machinery as the road to modernity, and here he drew heavily on the Soviet model and Soviet expertise. But he was also a liberal believer in parliaments, the rule of law, elections, and democratic governance, and in this he drew on Western and often British ideals from his days at private school, or what they call in Britain public school, and university. In India, because he was the chosen heir of the great Mahatma Gandhi, because of his personal charisma and his nationalist credentials, he was a virtual king in independent India. And his vision and the vision for India were close to one and the same. Nehru's vision for India, more or less one and the same, for about 15 years, 1947 to 1962, when the famous China-India war occurred and Nehru basically crashed, personally was destroyed by it and weakened and then died soon after. This vision had a brutalist element, though this term is a recent one. It was about exposure, size, strength, durability, and function. It was modernism in its developmental guise, that is, societal development. A race to catch up with the West, to achieve national sovereignty, and to solve all the wicked problems of history. Caste, poverty, etc., through massive state mobilizations of money, energy, and ideas. In this modernism, agriculture, tradition, and poverty were often identified with one another, and the countryside was seen as a backwater of ignorance and incompetence from which Indians could only be delivered by state-sponsored or state-dictated planning. What the Bauhaus program, through many channels, one of which, by the way, was their retro in the history or his complex, I can't go fully into it, that, of course, Corbusier was an influence on the Bauhaus. It was not that he was a descendant of Bauhaus, so it's a complicated story. But through many channels brought, what the Bauhaus program brought to Nehru's India through multiple channels was above all the idea, and I have this in capitals here, going back to the question of forms, knowledge forms that circulate, design, capital D-E-S-I-G-N. That's the form that I think we need to watch in its global form, today as well, but then. The Bauhaus idea of design, in my view, was a remarkable, even unique, this is of course a risky thing to say, but I can essay, try it, effort to combine arts and crafts with industrial production and mass functionality. This mix was ideal for someone like Nehru. I don't know its story here, but for someone like Nehru, it's a dream come true, who had an aesthetic sense but did not have a vocabulary to bring art and industry together on a mass basis. So Nehru was 100% committed to modernity, industry, technology, engineering, and so on, but his whole narrative of India, the narrative of the nation, was we are unique, we are a great synthesis of this and that, we have this art and these motifs and so on. Bauhaus was a dream for him because, and further, later for people like Correa and a ton of other architects, you could be in the spirit of Bauhaus and then add a little element from here and there, which was somehow Indian. Nehru was the first person to realize this, that this was perfect for him and his vision. This is what the Bauhaus offered, and in India it took numerous forms, the most important of which was the National Institute of Design, founded in 1961 in the same wave of enthusiasm for Bauhaus, in which the mix of art, craft, engineering, and industrial production found a discipline, not just some knowledge, it's a form, design, that was perfectly suited to Nehru and Nehru's India. The Bauhaus design vision put everything, and so far as I can see, it may have been new in this, but who knows, put everything from chairs and tables, and I gather from some of Beatrice Colomina's work, beds also, in the same frame as buildings and cities, under one vast disciplinary roof, and this roof, and did so in the name of a sort of emancipation, an emancipation from sentiment, from aestheticism, from romanticism, of course from ornamentation, all seen as obsessions with form. See, now things get interesting. So they're all seen as excessive concerns with form, of course. And here the idea of design codified by the Bauhaus has a special relationship to my interest, which I talked about briefly at the beginning, in the circulation of forms, for it is both, it, that is Bauhaus, is both a form, an idea of design, and an idea about form. It is a circulating metaphor. The political potential of Bauhaus for places like India, but also, I believe, for Europe and elsewhere, does not necessarily lie in its anti-traditionalism or its recognition of utility and function, or even in its pursuit of industrial scale and manufacturing as intimate accompaniments of art and craft. It lies, and this is the proposal I make to you, rather in a more abstract idea, which is that it could be, that is, design, as expressed by Bauhaus, but design could be the meta form of modernity, namely the visible and material vehicle of the present. That vanishing present which always eludes all societies, India, China, Japan, Europe, etc., US, all of which remain caught up in some kind of fantasy of the past, of history, and of memory. Bauhaus invents a meta form for modernity, a modernity which can be a visual landscape for a sensibility about pure possibility, pure futurity, pure newness. This is paradoxical, for though the content of the Bauhaus vision is that form should follow function, its own meta message is about form, but not any specific form, but the very form of modernity itself. This, I think, was the seductive force of modernist design and all its variations, most of which had Bauhaus elements for leaders like Nehru, for in this form of design ideology, they could pursue the form of modernity without sacrificing the content of national history, national aesthetics, national craft, and national memory. This seductive idea, of course, is an illusion. For traditional elements, motifs, styles, and icons in India's modernist architecture in the 50s, 60s, and beyond, up to today, reduces Indianness to ornament, and thus smuggles Indianness back into the abstract form of modernity inspired by Bauhaus principles. Thus, a peculiar Indian modernist sensibility emerges in architecture, cinema, fiction, and the performing arts in the 1960s, in which modernity becomes the form for the nationalist function. In this process, whether in Corbusier's Chandigarh or Satyajit Ray's films or many other novels, India becomes an ambivalent site for modernity as a form, for the function, for its function is not industrial or political or emancipatory, but simply national and nationalistic. This is the ambivalence which is now broken down in the India of Narendra Modi and the Hindu right, which has no interest in modernity as a circulating form, but only in the content of modernity, defined as global competitiveness, aggressive wealth making, and Hindu domination. The governing form today in India is an aggressive traditionalism, which fears diversity, minority, and cultural freedom. This anti-politics is much worse than Nehru's Bauhaus nationalism, which at least had the virtue of recognizing that modernity itself is a circulating form. In this sense, the Bauhaus message opened, at least for a few decades, an important debate about the portability of modernity as a form. I believe this is the key to the progressive political potential of the Bauhaus.